Welcome to the European Hockey Federation podcast, in conversation with the biggest names in hockey, generating insight and engagement around coaching, officiating and playing. Powered by Coach Logic and supported by the FIH Academy, presented by Jack Rolfe, the founder of the Coaching Lab. For this episode, we lifted the visor and for an in-depth conversation with global hockey star Maddie Hinch, covering her learnings and her opinions on what and who has helped her drive her success. Over to Jack.
Coaches, welcome. Thanks for checking in to another European Hockey Federation webinar. It's great to have you on board. And as ever, we've got a few different locations across the world, some a little bit sunnier than others. So it's cool to have you on board. And I know some of you will be up late and up early to catch this. So it's cool to have you on board. I'm Jack Rolfe, founder of the Coaching Lab and presenter for the series. Delighted again to have someone that's kind of in the centre of a lot of the elite stuff that's going on at the moment. It can, again, share some really honest thoughts, reflections and ideas to hopefully impact our coaching. So Maddie, welcome to the webinar. It's cool to have you on board.
Happy to be here.
For anyone that doesn't know, England and Great Britain goalkeeper, three-time World Player of the Year, Olympic and European champion, and has played in the best league in the world in Holland for Stixer, which we will get onto in a bit of a conversation this afternoon. Maddie, we've got three topics. We've kind of worked through these together. I'm pretty excited because I think they're impactful. I think you can share some knowledge to hopefully help other coaches not make the same mistakes, maybe that some of the environments that you've been in as a youngster and now as an elite athlete to support them. But also, every team has a goalkeeper. And it's something that we spoke about. It's potentially the forgotten position as well. So, you know, hopefully by the end of this, coaches, you know, got loads to take away. As ever, ask some questions as we go along, and we'll try and pick up as many questions as possible. Maddie, first area I'd like to pick on, I'd say pick on, discuss, would be the psychology of a goalkeeper, and I suppose the wider psychology of an elite athlete, an Olympic champion, a European champion. Talk to me about your mindset. I know this is a critical area. Is it something that's always been a focus for you? Is it something that you really look to develop, or are you grateful that maybe it's not something you need to develop as much compared to others?
It's something that I've had to work on a huge amount. For me, the mindset and the psychology and the strength of the psych of a goalkeeper is the difference between a good and a great one. It's such a unique position, and I always describe it as pretty much life on the edge. One action can basically change the outcome of a game in either direction. And it's a huge amount of pressure, incredibly demanding. And for me, that ability to accept that the role comes with mistakes, ability to park it, ability to move on, the ability to accept mistakes but reflect on those and be willing to open up and make yourself vulnerable is all this sort of stuff that I've had to kind of get to grips with, because being honest, as a young keeper and probably as a person, this is the side that I struggled with the most. And I, as a result, was incredibly inconsistent with how I performed, and incredibly hard on myself, and that can really kind of take its toll. So definitely something I've worked on a lot, but you know, when you kind of get to one stage, something else will come out, or your career, for example, with mine coming more into the limelight, I've had to be stronger with reading content that maybe I don't like to read, or people's opinions, and it's stuff that I didn't have to deal with as an 18-year-old, or even really the goalkeeper going into Rio. So yeah, a really tough side of the game, but essential for goalkeepers. It's something you really have to get to grips with.
And when was that moment that you realised, you kind of thought, right, I need a bit of a stronger mindset here as that young player, yeah, that young goalkeeper? Is there a situation or an age that you thought, right, I've really got to work on this?
Probably when I got dropped yet again. I mean, for me, my junior career was not a great one. I put the pads on for the first time when I was 13. I didn't actually kind of play for any sort of level until I was 18. And the feedback was constantly that I was just too inconsistent. One minute I could make a great save, but the next minute I'm letting stuff through me. And I think when I got to probably the point after the under 21s, so went out to the Junior World Cup with the 21s as number two, didn't play a single second. And then I was too old to be involved in the junior group, but I wasn't now invited to be part of the seniors. So I was kind of left in what some of us call like the grey zone or the grey area, where you have to make a decision. Like, okay, am I gonna carry on trying to push, or am I just gonna, do you know what, this is not for me. This is just not the kind of environment that I want to stay a part of. And for me, I had to, well, I've always been quite stubborn, and I felt deep down that I had something to give to the sport. And so I chose to move to Leicester Ladies. And I think it was around that period of time that I probably said to myself, right, the consistency is key. And that surely has to result to my mindset and what I'm saying to myself and the actions that I'm taking after a mistake or after a loss. I think the people that know me know I'm incredibly fiery. And that's a strength of my game, I'd say, but it's also a weakness. And it's that ability to control that and use it at the right time and be able to take a deep breath and step back and say, you know what, it's not the end of the world, it is just hockey. But when you're so passionate and you're, you know, you're putting everything on hold really to achieve the ultimate, it's hard.
And what is that moment? You don't have to be specific, but when you realise, I am getting too far here, I am getting close to the edge, what do you recognise that you kind of think, okay, I need to pull it back?
Yeah. Do you know what, this is still something that I get wrong. I think the difference between now and me as a young keeper was the fieriness happened in the game. And you'd see it from me, like, they called it the Maddie Paddy quite a lot. And it was very true. Like, it breaks sticks, kind of, you could see it in my body language, and it's just not something a goalkeeper can really portray. You have to have a presence of confidence. Mainly for your teammates in front of you. And for me, losing my temper or losing my control does not give off the kind of image or vibes that I want to give to my team, that, you know, they're turning around going, God, we've lost our keeper here, and that'll make them nervous. So, yeah, I think now I would say my game routine is very consistent. There's not an awful lot that would throw me off. I feel like I've kind of created a little like world for myself that when it's match day, it doesn't matter what happens. I just kind of know the plan and that's okay. But again, that's taken years. I think for me, it's the post-game stuff now that is still a work on. You know, I take things incredibly personally, and I probably take it more personally now than I ever have, because I feel my role is even more important. I feel like being an older athlete, that I must deliver more than ever. But it's that kind of words that I use. You know, I must, I have to. That's the side of stuff that I have to change. And that's the stuff I continue to work on. And for me, it's being willing to open up and talk to teammates and talk to my coaches immediately after a match. Whereas naturally I go quite isolated and just feel sorry for myself. But if I can straight away go, hey, I'm feeling crap about how that just went, it's a hell of a lot easier.
Let's pick up on before a game, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think every goalkeeper at every level and every coach has probably seen similar situations. Yeah. Where they smash the post or they get really angry with themselves. Without giving too much away, what is your routine, or what does your routine look like for you to say to another goalkeeper, this is what I think you can do to support that transition into the game?
I think routine fundamentally is key. And working out what works for you, and again, that takes a bit of time. But then once you think, okay, I've got it, stick with it. I think mine has been the same for years. Barely anything has changed from kind of my physical. I do the same sort of exercises, but I'm a bit OCD with this stuff. But same song in my iPad, in my headphones. And then for me, like the pre-game match stuff, you know, it's very important that I tell the coaches what I want and what I need, because essentially a goalkeeper's warm-up needs to make me feel confident, ready, nerves settled, and feeling sharp. So, you know, I've always had the traditional kind of four or five technical things I want to work on and build up the intensity, shots from angles. And then with the guy, when I come into the team part, for me, there has to be an element of decision-making. I have to get my brain switched on. It's very easy as a goalkeeper to just like kick or make hand saves without even having to think. But in a match, it's decision making. Stopping the ball is easy, making the right decision is the hard bit. So if there's not an element of decision making in my warm up, then I'm missing a trick. And I think that's something that maybe coaches sometimes don't factor for us. They'll do the little small sided games for the outfield players over there, but we might not get that. So for me, the kind of varied shots or rebounds or the extra bit of, it's quite hard to explain, but basically not something that's so prescribed is essential in a pre-game warm-up. Whatever happens when I walk off that pitch, I feel ready because it's been the same every single time. And you know what? If I come off and I haven't had a sugar, I can't be like, it's because I didn't do this in my warm-up. It's just, okay, well, today just wasn't a day. I did everything as I did in my last game where I played great. So routine is essential.
And there's a lot of coaches on this call. What's one thing you'd say to coaches, maybe not to say, and maybe one thing to say when something doesn't necessarily go to plan?
That's a tough one.
Put you on the spot there, Maddie. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Again, it's so individual. Some keepers will want that pat on the back. Some will not. I think for me, again, I go quite into my own little world on match day. I don't particularly need a coach to tell me a certain thing. I don't, you know, it's not for them. If I'm relying on a coach to say something to me before a game and then one day they forget to say it, that could throw me off. So for me, a pre-game warm-up is something that's totally in my control and that I know will happen. Every box will be ticked before I go on the pitch. So I personally don't like to rely on maybe a coach saying, have a great game. If I get it, great. I've probably not even heard it, to be honest, because I'm in the zone. But I think for keepers, you know, it's the same with the players. We talk about with the players, if you let a goal in, the girls will go, what do you want me to say in that moment? You know, even, that's okay, next one. That would annoy me. Like, because then it's like, well, I know that. And now I know that you've seen that it was a mistake or whatever. So I think that's just communication between players and coaches as to what that player needs from them in that moment. Some will really need their confidence building, and that might be something that they have to seek every time. And some might just need to be left alone. Same going into shootouts. I don't need people going, you got this, Mads. Don't want it. I don't want to hear it. Like, it's my time. So I'm just focused. So again, from a coach's perspective, it's just that open conversation with your goalkeeper. What do you need from me? What do you need from me when it's going well, and what do you need from me when it's not going so well?
Yeah, and I think the common trend is what you said there is probably to know the person that's under the helmet, and not to forget the person that's between the two posts, which I think as coaches we're probably all potentially a little bit guilty of, is maybe not having as many conversations with the people that are furthest away from us rather than the person that's closest to the sideline.
Yeah, definitely. I think you know, it's such the position is so strange because you're so individual yet part of a team. And I think coaches can naturally sometimes just kind of forget about the goalkeeper, not intentionally, but they just forget, like they're planning their sessions, but it's just like, oh, a shot at the end for the goalkeeper. But actually, what is the goalkeeper trying to achieve through that session? You know, just having shots at goal is fine to an element, but if you do that all the time, again, what are you training your brain? You're not actually training them to make any decisions. And like I said before, decision making is key, and that comes with experience. But the more you can train that in your training environment, the more they're likely to make better decisions over time. So it has to be a balance. You know, for me, there has to be a technical element, there has to be some shooting, and there has to be some gameplay, some bit that's going to make your goalkeeper have to think. And again, that's chatting to your goalkeeper, setting goals beforehand, whether you've got a goalkeeper coach or not, and just working out what that goalkeeper needs from that session. You know, those conversations, I think for any goalkeeper, give them a huge amount of like belief that they value them in the team. And I think there's periods in my career where I've been like, do you know what? Like, I feel like a cone today. That's sometimes what I say, like a cone could have done more than me. Did you even think about me being, did you even notice I was here? And that's a horrible feeling, because I think as a keeper, you naturally do always feel quite different. So if a coach can work quite hard on keeping them connected, you're going to get an awful lot more out of your goalkeeper and a better connection between not just the players, but your backline in particular.
And have you had some coaches that would be pretty open to you going in on almost briefings of meetings and saying, right, this is what the session plan should look like?
Yeah, definitely. But it's always taken, I think, me to initiate that. And I think partly because a coach has a huge amount to think about. You know, they have all the players that they're trying to manage, plus the tactical side of it, session plans. It's just as how it happens that the goalkeeper tends to fit in at the bottom, not intentionally. So I think naturally over time, as I've got older, I've got more confidence to be able to walk up to my coach and say, look, this is what I feel I need over this block of training. And I'm very much a visual like learner, and I want to see evidence of what I'm getting out of my next block or what I'm getting out of this next period of training. So I might walk up to the coach and say, okay, this is what I feel I need. Like, can we get some small sided gameplay in here? Because I'm working on this with my goalkeeper coach. But I'm a bit of a geek with this stuff. For me, if I see that this stuff is going to get ticked throughout that period, then I know I've done it. So for me, I can look back and say, yep, tick that box. So as we head into the tournament, there's nothing more I feel I could have done, rather than, I wonder if I'm going to get in any like smothering work this week. I wonder if we're going to get in any hands. If you're guessing, just go and ask. Because most of the time they can provide that time for you. But it is sometimes a bit scary, especially as a young keeper, to go up and be like, hello, remember me? So just be open.
And just picking up on one thing you say, it's geeking out, knowing about everything, but I think it's probably a characteristic of an elite player's mindset, which was one of the questions of what characteristics, or what are the characteristics of a world champion? If you look and you think, both maybe as a goalkeeper and the playing group that won the Europeans and the Olympics, and you kind of said, okay, what are the three characteristics that were kind of non-negotiable in that group?
From a group's perspective, I think a level of togetherness was key. I think a lot of people saw that in Rio. You know, we were hands up, say, were we the best hockey players there? No, we weren't. But were we the best team? Yes, we were. Our level of togetherness only got stronger the more people threw at us. And that was created from just so much time back at Bisham Abbey, being able to create those connections and have those open and honest conversations about what do you need from me in this exact moment. If I see you're having a bit of a difficult time, what can I say to help you? We knew that about every single player. Another thing, I guess, is the ability to block out the external factors. I think we were a team that, again, did quite a lot to make sure we stayed in our own little bubble. And stayed tight. So again, nothing could kind of throw us off our plan. I think for me, they were probably the main two. When I think of like successful teams, I just think of how tight you are as a unit. And that's not, everyone likes each other. I can assure you that's not the case. We're not all mates. But when you step on a pitch, it's just like I can look someone in the eyes and I just know exactly that they are going to be the one fighting for me, or I know that they know I'm there for them. And that does not come by just putting a bunch of players together and saying, you guys are together. It works from being able to get off the hockey pitch and spend that time together to openly say to one another, this is what I need from you. And you know what, today, Maddie, you didn't give that from me. And it's hard. It's hard to be that honest to one another. But we've been through so much as a team. We had no choice but to say, okay, right, how are we going to make ourselves gold medalists? Because at the minute, one minute we're here and 1 minute we're here. The togetherness is essential in my eyes.
And just picking up when you went into the program, obviously younger and probably hadn't had that international experience as many as some of the other girls that went, you know, all the way through. Yeah. What are some of the behaviours and characteristics, attributes that you kind of thought, okay, this is what I'm seeing here, this is what I need to develop in that elite environment?
Yeah, I think an ability to accept criticism and not take it personally was huge. Because again, like, you'd have your Kates and your Helens kind of saying, what was that? Like, and to be honest, as a young keeper or a young player, you can be quite protected and no one would actually ever say those sort of things to you. As soon as I arrived at Bisham, it was like, there's no hiding place here. And if you can't handle it, you don't belong. So it was that ability to get strong quickly mentally and physically. An environment that was incredibly honest to one another, training at a level that was probably beyond what was actually required, an ability to push yourselves, ability to go completely out of your comfort zone and be able to stay kind of in the moment. We were tested like that an awful lot, both physically and mentally. And again, as soon as you arrived at Bisham, it was like a place that you had to get accepted. You had to work you had to work for your kind of acceptance among the team and why you deserved your spot there over someone else in the country that wanted to be there as well. And so again, that takes a bit of time and you have to earn your respect as such. And I think, when you're coming into an environment with players that have missed Olympic Games and have won this, like you just sit and listen and learn and take it all in. And work hard and prove that you how much you want it. I think that's what it's the same for me now in the squad. When a new player comes in, all I want to see from them is the like fire in their eyes and determination that they want to be here and they'll do anything to help us win. And I've created that, I guess, mindset from the guys that taught me that from the day I turned up at Bisham.
Brilliant. Just going to pick up a couple of questions before we go on to the kind of the next area of discussion. One from Lawrence Mead. What do you think are the key principles, values of good goalkeeping?
Number one, it sounds a bit basic, but it is stopping the ball. And there is no perfect save. And for me, this is essential in that I think coaches to recognise that you're not trying to create a goalkeeper that is a Matty Hinch or a Vinny Vanash. It's essentially what are their strengths. For me, I was always quite different as a young keeper. I think that's probably why I struggled early days, because I wanted to be dynamic and I wanted to run around in my kit and I didn't want to just stand there. And at first, I think a lot of coaches feared that kind of difference. And if anything, they saw that as weaknesses, whereas one day, finally, someone said to me, do you know what? Matty is probably one of the most dynamic keepers I've ever seen. How can we make this a super strength? But we do need to teach her how to use it at the right time. So I always say to the kids, just stop the ball. Stop the ball in whatever way works for you and you think is best. And of course, you can add elements to help them technically get to those points, but don't try and mold them into a keeper that someone else is doing. You know, you've had Beth Story, world number one in the past, incredibly different keeper to me. But yet she was my idol, but I was never trying to be Beth. I was just trying to be Matty. Physically, I do feel these days with the way the game is going that you have to be athletic. You have to be dynamic and have a good balance and good coordination. For me, I feel the goalkeeper should be the most athletic person on the pitch. And I think that's something that catches people out of surprise. I think they should be the fastest over 5 metres. But that's obviously just my opinion. And decision-making, again, we go back to that, making positive decisions. But then at the same time, when you get the decision wrong, a level of calm and a level of, you know, not like I said earlier, not throwing your toys out of the pram and being able to kind of see things clearly. And then I guess the final thing would be a scholar of the game. I think the goalkeeper should understand the game as good as anyone. At the end of the day, we can see it better than anyone on the pitch. So you need to be able to read the game well. I think that resorts back to how much work I do behind the video to try and almost see scenarios before they even happen. Because then when those moments come, your instinct comes into play because of almost the homework that you've done behind the scenes.
We're going to get onto the video and the kind of reflection stuff in a moment. And Maddie, you'll like this. More coaches are asking questions about goalkeepers and coaches, which is a good one, a session design. So one from Ben Barnes, what are your most fun and engaging practices? Are they coach-led or are they ones that you construct with the coach?
Ben, I know Ben, so hi Ben. this is weird for me because Ben, I swear, it was always a coach. A combination of both. I again, it's quite personal. I like to feel a level of ownership of the sessions that are being delivered. So I work closely with the goalkeeper coach and the head coach to try and have some sort of say in how those sessions are delivered to impact us and help us. Or if I haven't got the time to do that with them, I will always just feedback, okay, hey Mark, that really worked well for us. So just so you're planting that seed. For me, small-sided games is massive, because you get the element of plenty of action with all different types of decisions to be made, shots from angles, shots from far, close shots, rebounds. So for me, small-sided games is the number one kind of drill, or, you know, the overload scenarios where essentially you've got to set up your two defenders that you have left on a turnover to create a scenario that is the best possible outcome given that there is an overload. So how do you line up your defenders to make sure the shot comes from wide as an angle that gives you the best percentage save? You know, there are the sort of drills that I really like with not much time to think.
Cool. Ben's got a follow-up question here. Do you have a specific way or place to relax and get away from it all?
I do. I think this is something that I've had to learn over the last couple of years, in particular around my break. When I had the break, I think I had to learn to do that. I think a lot of athletes will say this, that it's actually incredibly hard to switch off even in your off season. Because most of the time you're having to look after yourself and train, and when you're training in the gym, there's a purpose to it. So for me, I have a dog now, and actually she is huge in me being able to almost like take my focus somewhere else. Have a real switch off area.
I got you. You might want to say that last bit again, Maddie. I think we just froze there.
Okay. For me, home is essentially where I like to be the most at the minute. I think that's weird that the scenario that we all find ourselves in now, for me, I've really kind of valued the time at home, and I probably appreciate it more than I ever have. And obviously having a dog is super nice as well.
It's a question that I think's come up every single webinar we've done, whether we spoke with a coach or a player or anyone from elite environment. And I think the common trend is exactly what you said, was having an interest away from hockey and not letting hockey take over your life.
Yeah, definitely. It's quite hard to learn. I mean, I work quite closely with a number of psychologists at the minute. And one of the things that someone made me do not too long ago was kind of draw a wheel and put in like the sections in the wheel that I value the most. And like straight away when I first drew it, I was like, hockey. It's like this huge pie of like this wheel. I was like, that's what I put the most time and energy into rather than value. And then over time I started to realize, what am I doing? I was like, actually, number one is my family. Like that is what I value the most. And then my health and my friends and hockey actually ended up being like down here. And that was for me actually a true reflection. But because my brain was so frazzled with just hockey, that I couldn't even see that. And it took someone to actually make me go, come on a second, like what do you actually value? So now when I find myself running away a little bit with the hockey side of things, I go back to this like little wheel and I say, no, this is more important. It just makes you realize at the end of the day, it is just hockey. And I think that's always the approach I had younger when you're playing more with a smile on your face. But as you get to the elite level, it's quite hard to almost enjoy it because of all the extra factors. And for me, I play because I love the game and I have to keep trying to bring myself back there as much as possible, especially at this stage in my career, because there's not a huge amount left of it. So I want to enjoy what I have.
I was going to say that. And I suppose for some of the youngsters as well, that element of transition, that if we as coaches can promote, you know, almost freedom outside of hockey as well, it's probably going to make the transition a bit easier.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something that I've tried to portray a little bit more, I guess, through like my social channels, is like the normality of me, like that I'm just a human and that I like to do things. And I also will sometimes have a chocolate bar or I'll have a drink. And like, it's like, I'm allowed to switch off and I don't feel guilty for that. And I think there's a lot of athletes and myself in particular in the past where I probably did. But now I see like that part of my day or my week as part of my training to help me be better. So it's part of the reason why I chose not to play club this year, is because I felt strongly that I need to start giving back to myself more and giving myself that time and space. And what was club going to give me? An extra session on the pitch? Do I need that right now? No. And do I actually just be able to clear my head at the weekend and come in Monday fresh? You know, that was a hard decision, but it was absolutely the right one.
Just a bit of a specific question from Sharon Bolton here. If you were to offer one advice to yourself as a 13-year-old goalkeeper, what would it be?
Oh, a 13-year-old. I mean, I just put the pads on.
Maybe a youngster, we'll say instead.
Yeah, a young goalkeeper. I think if I could have looked back at my setbacks as more of like step forwards, if that makes sense. Again, it's so easy to say now, and that in the moment when you're crying your eyes out because you've been dropped again, or that email's come through that you're not on. Like, I generally believe that if I had not had that journey as a kid, that I wouldn't be where I am now. I think I could have made it okay, like, and just maybe been in the mix, but would I be a world number one? No, I don't think so. I think that those tough days make you so strong, like they make you realize how much you don't want it. So I think it would have been a lot easier, I guess, in those moments as a kid if I could have, you know, understood that. But that's easier said than done. But that would be something that I say to myself, that it's just part of the journey, and like look at that as a hurdle to overcome that will only make you stronger.
And I suppose when we are selecting youngsters, probably give them reasons why they have been selected, so they understand why they're really good, and maybe when they're not selected, some stuff to potentially work on as well.
100%. I mean, that the first point around like why are you selected? I guess people forget, almost forget to tell you that. It's like, oh, your name's on the list. Okay, great. Well, why? And I remember actually in the lead up to a tournament, I think it's actually, yeah, it was the Euros that we went on to win. Danny sat down and like went through all the team positions and we're all sat around and it was like, okay, so Maddie, I've picked you because of this, this and this. And it was like the first time really I'd heard why I was actually in the team. And the feeling that I got was like, oh my goodness, okay, he thinks I'm quite good here. And then I think everyone walked out that room being like, because he went through every single player, took the time to do so, to be like, I know my purpose and the reason I've been named over so-and-so and basically I need to go and deliver on those things and we'll be all right.
Nice. I think that's something again for coaches to take away. And you know, when you are doing selection of working out why people are in, so that's awesome. Got a question from Barry Hainsworth. Is there another sport you find beneficial for your training or reactions?
I mean, I think I get asked this question quite a lot in terms of, you know, when kids are starting to like really, I want to play for my county, like how much do I focus on this? And for me, I also believe that I had quite a balanced like opportunities within sport between like 13 and 18, the opportunity to play loads of different things, and I did. And again, I feel like that has, without me even really knowing, had an impact on the way I play. So I particularly love squash, and maybe that was a part around my footwork and my conditioning. I did athletics, so I was always on the sprint track. Swimming, tennis, like you could go through those and say, yeah, I got that and that. I don't know for sure what I got, but I generally think having a broad spectrum of, you know, exposure to different sports as a kid was vital, and I would never expect anyone to kind of narrow their choices too soon. So yeah, that was what I say.
And age 13, I suppose, is potentially later than some other people as yeah. well to put on the pads and go and goal. We've seen 5-6-year-olds, 7-year-olds go in and you kind of think, wow. Yeah. But 13's a little bit later.
Yeah, I was definitely like a bit of a late bloomer for sure. I mean, I see it more than anything on my camps, like these little kiddies, like 6 years old, and they're like, when did you start? I'm like 13. They're like, whoa, that's so old. And I'm like, yeah, so think about all the years that you have on me. But again, do I think, I remember Beth's story before me, she actually put on the pads quite late as well and was quite late into the setup. At the end of the day, goalkeeping is, there's so much to it around experience. I remember someone saying to me, you're not actually going to be any good until you're 27. And I was like, eh? And they're like, well, because it just takes time to learn. One, you have to work your way into that number one position where you're regularly playing. It took me till I was 24 to get that. And then really I learned everything that I needed leading to the Olympics over that four years beforehand, because I went through everything a goalkeeper could do, from mistakes at final seconds that lost us medals, you know, losing a Commonwealth gold medal with 10 seconds to go on a defensive corner that we were supposed to keep out, and things like that, like the highs and lows that I experienced and the ups and downs. But the coach leaving me in there to learn for me was key, and actually saying the shirt is yours at the beginning when it was handed to me in 2013, and saying kind of, you know, we're not going to take this off you anytime soon, find your feet. And if then I hadn't done it, of course it would have been passed on, but it was that confidence from the coach to be like, we believe you deserve this now, go and find your feet. You know, I had 5 caps to my name. I wasn't going to go out and smash it straight away. I had to learn my way and learn the role. So yeah,
no, I think that's valuable, and I think it's an easy thing to blame the goalkeeper and just get rid of the goalkeeper yeah. without giving them the opportunity to find out who they are and what their roles are.
100%, and everyone has bad days, you know, like and that's the hard part of being a keeper. You wait so long to get your opportunity that when it comes, it's like so much bigger than it needs to be. So it's like you can't win because you've got all this like pressure of being a goalkeeper number one, but also being a goalkeeper that they might then drop you for the other goalkeeper. Like you've got someone on the bench all the time that's going, hello, like pick me, oh she made a mistake, pick me, I can do it. Like that's just it's such a weird world. And I can't emphasize more enough like that, but showing, as hard as that is maybe to put a keeper above someone and say, look, this is why we're playing you, and stick with it for a little bit of time to kind of get a true reflection of what that keeper is about is essential. And then of course it's the same for me now, like if I have a bad run of form consistently, my shirt will become less stable, and that's elite sport.
And to this day, do you know why you ended up in goal? Who was the teacher that kind of said, right, Maddie, 13 years old, you're going in goal? Do you know why they put you there?
I do, actually. So I joined a school in the summer term. My dad was in the Navy. We travelled quite a lot as a family. I went to so many different schools. And I joined the school in the summer term, and they were playing rounders. And I was apparently incredibly dramatic in a rounders field, like diving for balls here and there. And I remember a rounders coach at the time, Miss Lambert, she said to me, "Right, Maddie, next term, we think you should be the goalkeeper." And at the time, I was like, what is she on about? One, what is hockey? And a goalkeeper, I mean, I was someone that liked to kind of be in the thick of the action. So for me, it didn't sound particularly appealing. And to this day, I generally believe it was just because I was the new kid. And back then, no one wants to put the pads on. Different story today, but it was just a case of, oh, here you go. So they claim they spotted something, but I'm pretty sure it was just because I was the new girl. But yeah, looking back now, I suit the role. Ideally, like, I'm fearless, and the pads feel like a second skin to me, and they did from the get-go. And I think that's a huge sign for, like, anyone looking for future talent, is like, when they put the pads on, do they start walking around like a bit of a robot, or actually is it they can, like, roll around, jump around, bounce up, and it, like I say, feels like a second skin. Is a huge start to kind of their journey.
And the game, the note of cross sport in that. That was the first thing you mentioned as well, which is interesting.
You would have thought my rounders career would have a
Olympic
part
champion. Yeah. Okay, final part, Maddie, and I think this is probably the bit you're most excited about, playing in the hockey capital in Holland. I think we're going to share just a few ideas of reflections, I suppose, of why, what's it like, what did you take from it? What influenced you to do that? And ultimately, what have you taken back? So do you want to give a bit of background of who you ended up playing for? They were pretty good.
Yeah, they were pretty good. So I played 3 seasons in the end at Stixa. You know, again, it was something that when I joined the national program, I looked at a number of, like, our best players, and pretty much all of them had experience in Holland. And they would talk about it in such a fond way, and great memories. And, like, if you ever get the chance, you've got to go. But as obviously the program's grown, it's become more and more difficult to actually play over there. I had to push pretty hard to go. And I'm so glad I did. It is everything that you would want out of a club system and more. So when they say to you, it's great, trust me, it's great. And it's better than they're saying. You know, my opportunity to with Stixa actually came pretty randomly, because to actually sign for a club over there is pretty tough. And as a goalkeeper, it's really hard, especially if you're offering a 1-year contract with potentially a second half of the season flying back and forth and all this kind of difficult parts to it. So I was really struggling, and then Stixa's keeper just suddenly decided to step aside in, like, the middle of the season. So I got this phone call from Nettie van Marsakker and was like, do you want to come play for us? I mean, deep down I'm like, play it cool, man, play it cool. But they're top four, like, constantly fighting to win the league. Full of stars, I was like, I'm there. So signed for them, and the most unbelievable experience. You know, it comes from the way they build a structure around families in the clubs. So that was the first thing that hit me, in terms of mom and dad are there involved on some level, but all the kids are playing. You know, you walk on and there's hundreds of kids, just like tiny ones running around with sticks. It's just an unbelievably, like, nice community. It's quite hard to explain it, but it's just everyone is so tight and everyone wants the best for you. So if you're playing for the women's Damazane, the kids are like, whoa, and that's what you want. And, like, they don't even know whether you play internationally, but for them, Damazane means you must be good and I'm going to pay attention to you. Mm-hmm. So on match day, there's hundreds of people there. You know, the clubhouse is right next to the pitch, there's a bar going, it's an atmosphere, there's music, like, it's everything that you want, really. It's kind of more of a showcase. Yeah, it's great. Like, we train 5 times a week. It's as much as we do at Bishop on the pitch. And so it's that level of, this is important, you know? This is why we're here and we're taking up five pitch sessions, because we want to win. And it's that competitiveness, but also that balance of enjoy your game that I think they get very right over there. And yeah, I would highly recommend it to any, not just goalkeeper or a player, if you get the chance, don't hesitate.
Yeah, even just to go over there for the weekend as well, because I think it's an awesome place to be. I think it's about the only place in the world you can go into a clubhouse and get a proper coffee and go and watch some good hockey, and just incredibly functional. And I suppose, as you said there, just family driven. You know, they have homework clubs, don't they? And everyone's accessible. The players are accessible.
Yeah, definitely. And at the end of the day, people say, like, why can't we create this sort of stuff here? There are factors that, like, the fact that the country is tiny. You know, when we had an away game, I remember on our first Friday, it was like 2 hours away, and the girls are like, we must go the night before. And I was like, I traveled 2 hours on Tuesday and Thursday to Holcombe. What are you on about? But it's just like, they're used to, you know, 20 minutes cycling. I cycled to my sessions. It took me 35 seconds to get to my pitch session at the start of my career there, on my bike with the bag on the front, which again took me some time to get used to, but that's how they do it. They're just doing an awful lot right. And I just think, you know, people want to watch it, but they also, that environment of getting people into the games and making it more than just the hockey, I think is key. Like, I know a lot of those people that stood there with their beers watching the game are probably not really watching the game, but they're having a lovely time in the sun, they're chatting hockey with everyone around. All the other kids are out on pitch 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, knocking around. They've obviously got a long history of doing things well, and I think it's definitely something we have to pay attention to and work out what we can take from it. But there are factors like the size of the country, the fact that they don't have school sports, so all the kids come out at 2, 3 o'clock and they're off to their clubs, so there's waiting lists at hockey clubs. You know, there are factors that we can't compete with, but there are definitely some things that they're doing that we should pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, I think that's good context, not having a school sport, which is, you know, huge over here, that, you know, kids from school would then go and play their club sport at the club. Maddie, the golden question here, you're allowed two things to take from Holland to bring back to you English hockey. What would they be?
Oof. God, tough. One thing that, again, I think could be quite achievable, because a lot of clubs do have this sort of setup. Not everyone, but if you do, like the fact that we ate our meals together after training. So I'd have food, lunch on a Thursday and dinner in between our sessions. Tuesday was dinner with the team, Friday was dinner with the team. And like Friday nights was always a bit of a social, like there was that element, you've trained really hard this week, match day is Sunday, let's have a couple of drinks, let's chill, it was an environment where you wanted to be with your team. It wasn't a case of, I've showered, see you later guys, see you Sunday. Like, it was that you would expect it to be there. And that level of, unless you've got a real damn good excuse, we expect you to be here and want to be here and sit around the table. And you know, we'd have dinner and people would still be there 2 hours later because you're just chatting. And that side of it for me grabs me so much. And I remember chatting to some of the Holcombe girls and being like, can we try and replicate that? But then obviously the difficulty is people are saying, I'm up for 7 a.m. work tomorrow, or I've got a 2 hour journey back, I can't hang around at the club. So it's how you achieve those sort of things. So for me, that's number one. And then I guess it would be like the exposure to the club game. Again, how do you achieve that? I know we're trying, like with you Galvanize and Beeston, trying to capture the games. I think we have to keep trying to do that. I think we have to keep trying to show the game as much as we can, as hard as this is getting every single day. The fact that on a Sunday night, we were all able to watch the highlights on TV, or even the highlights that they upload to YouTube, were of great quality, gave you a real impact of how cool this game is. And that is something we still need to strive for. Do I have the answers on how we achieve these? No. But for me, those two things were massive in how they basically kept people in the game and wanted to be part of what they were doing.
And you would have played some Friday, Sunday games, I suppose. That would have been a regular occurrence.
I mean, if you could have Friday night lights every Friday, that would be the dream. There was nothing better than an 8 p.m. game. That was the time of the match on a Friday, but it was packed. We had a few of those. And yeah, I remember we had a couple of those in the UK. I swear we actually always got more on the Friday one. So can we look at our structure and make more of an atmosphere and just remember that it's more than just the hockey? Like, how do we create a sense of fun, excitement, a bit of a party, a bit of a time for people to relax and let their hair down? Like, that is, it's all about the kind of environment, the atmosphere we're creating, more than just what is actually happening on the pitch. And I think that's what the Dutch do an awful lot well. And the fact then that the club turns into a disco afterwards, again, like, mad, they are mental, but so cool, and just made me want to be there. It was incredibly hard to leave, I have to say.
Yeah, people go for a night out in the clubhouse rather than into the city, which is unbelievable.
Teddies, that's what they're called.
And I suppose a lot of what we spoke about there is I suppose, a bit of a challenge to clubs. I think all on this call that, as we said before, it doesn't require lots of money. I think it requires just a bit of a different mindset and maybe asking, why can't we do this as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we have to, being honest, I think we have to, as a country and as a club setup, be more willing to change. Because I think if we're all honest with ourselves, it's not where we want it to be. But I know people are scared of change and stuck in their ways, but like, let's look at what these guys are doing. There's a reason that they're producing the players that they are on a consistent basis. And because the kids are picking up sticks from tiny and they're aspiring to be your Kai van Marsaki, Van der Hervel, because they're watching them at their club games every weekend. We can't give the exposure of ourselves as athletes by just playing international. You know, watching us through TV isn't a true reflection of us. Being able to go down to the hockey pitch and see your sporting icons right there in front of you doing their thing, that's how you inspire a generation. And for right now, getting people to the games is the biggest problem we have. So how do we change? How do we change that? And if we're not willing to, we're going to be saying this sort of stuff for years. And so, you know, Rio brought in a mass participation increase, but for me, there was not enough change to that demand to play the game. And yeah, we're still talking about it today.
We both could have grey hair, Maddie, I think, by the time it could happen. Liv, Masdorp, do they charge people to watch club hockey? I think that's an important question.
No, not a penny. No. And that, again, a big factor. And like, I know people say, yeah, but they've got the money behind it. They don't. Like, they create their money through the bars. Like, they create their money by getting people in there and giving them a beer and giving them a coffee. And then so-and-so saying, I had a great time down at the game. I actually don't know what the score was, but it was really fun. They had great music. And so that next week, their mate comes along and you can just walk in to this like unbelievable setup and see it. If we can't get people through the front door because we're charging them 15 quid, they'll probably turn around and go do something else. Like, again, like, we have to open up our doors and invite people in to show them what we're doing, and then try and keep them there.
I hope some people have listened to that, Maddie. One final question on Holland and the hockey capital, and I suppose a bit more specific to you. What did you take from the experience, maybe as a person, but also as a goalkeeper?
As a person, the balance, I think. Like, you look at these guys that have won multiple gold medals, like triple gold medals. They do have an ability to switch off and enjoy themselves and not have the intensity that's required all the time. I think we have kind of created a little bit of an environment that probably doesn't allow you to feel comfortable with that. In Holland, it was like, you can train hard, but you can also then enjoy what you're doing. And also, if you then had too much time enjoying, they would tell you on Monday that you are here for a purpose. So it's not that it was just all super relaxed. Very much not the case. I felt pressure there to deliver more than probably over here, purely because they were accepting me into their league and I had to prove my value there. But at the same time, on a Friday, they expected you to have a nice time with them and be part of the group and get stuck into the culture. So for me, that was my one takeaway. Like, there's club hockey is where you start. So, and you do it because you love it and you love being around your team. And I'd kind of lost my way a little bit with that, with like program life just being so intense and international hockey being so intense, that it was great to be able to see that, you know, triple gold medalists can also switch off. And they kind of showed me how to do that, which was good. Mm-hmm.
Cool. We just want to pick up on a couple of questions. Maybe you could do these in Dutch
for us.
Okay. Gareth Ikin, one piece of advice you would give to a goalkeeping coach?
I could give quite a bit of advice.
Your top two then.
Top two things. For me, work out what the goalkeeper offers, what their strengths are. So, you know, it could not be anything to do with actually being a goalkeeper. They could just be like quite quick. Okay, so if they're quick, how do we make them like super quick? For me, the coaches that really transformed me into the keeper that I am today saw those strengths and made them to super strengths. So you have them in the locker when required. So for me, that would be able to recognize what that is, but then also train your keeper to stop the balls that they should. So I had to learn quickly that you only get picked if you're consistent, and that's by stopping the majority of shots that are kind of in your zone. Whereas I wanted to do the top right dives, teach your goalies the importance of this and how this will help you get picked on a more regular basis.
Cool. Another one from Lawrence Mead. Do you think the current trend at international level of goalkeeping rotations every quarter half is a positive step? How do goalkeepers feel about this?
Oh, this is such a good question because I hate it. I remember when Danny was like, you're going to play a quarter? And I was like, eh, what's that about? Look, this is my opinion and it's just how I feel. I personally don't get it because I think you learn a lot about a keeper's ability to be, you know, a number one factor is that you have to concentrate. You have to be able to concentrate for the length of the game and be able to dip in and out at times that are required at different phases of matches. In a quarter, you don't get that. You almost can go on and go, I've got 50 minutes focus, 50 minutes focus. Okay, I've got some chill time. That is not the reality of an Olympic final. So for me, I don't get it, but I can see why early stage, if you're trying to work out who your keeper is, getting them some exposure is better than none. So from a coach's perspective, I can kind of see why they do it. But from a goalkeeper perspective, I don't like it and I don't get it, if that makes sense. So I know like a lot of our keepers here now are getting like little chip, more chipaways at match play and experience. Whereas when I was growing up, you know, it was either you got a game or you didn't. And majority of the time as a number two or three, I just didn't. So yeah, pros and cons to both, I suppose.
Nice. Maddie, I have five quick fire kind of questions and you can take as long as you wish on them. Number one, best piece of advice you've ever been given?
If you don't believe in yourself, then who's going to?
Nice. Message to your younger self?
What I said earlier about the ability to look at setbacks as learnings to only make you stronger.
What do you do better than anyone else?
What do I do better than anyone else?
Yeah.
It's always hard to say like good things about yourself. I think I move in my kit better than any female goalkeeper.
Cool. One moment you'd like to replay, either because it was awesome or to make a different decision?
I would like to just redo the Olympic final all over again. Like every week would be nice.
Nice. And then the final one characteristic you remember about your junior coaches?
Passionate. I think they had a passion for the game that only made me want to play well for them.
Nice. Awesome. Maddie, top stuff. Thank you very much for giving up your time. I know you've got a load of Zoom calls to do and everything, so we're very grateful. And as ever, coaches, kind of share your reflections online and across social media, and it'll be great to generate some further conversation. And hopefully, I think we don't forget about the goalkeeper. You've got a bit more time on your hands now, coaches, to have a flick, an idea through. So, Maddie, again, thanks very much. All the very best for next year's Olympics. You've got again another bit more time. And as ever, coaches, you'll be up on Coach Godric in the next couple of days. So.
Thank you for listening to the European Hockey Federation podcast, presented by the Coaching Lab, powered by Coach Logic, and supported by the FIH Academy. More podcasts will follow for Series 1 over the next 6 weeks. Follow EuroHockey.org on all social media to keep in touch.